Hello and welcome to the Philosopher's Zone. I'm Alan Saunders. Oscar Wilde once said that a map of the world without utopia on it was not worth having. I tend to disagree, perhaps because I have an instinctive conservative's instinctive distrust of the vision thing and of blueprints for the future. In actual fact, though, utopias come in many kinds. They don't have to be plans for the future. They can be criticisms of the present. Well, at the 12th International Congress of Historical Sciences, held at the University of New South Wales, Hayden White, University Professor Emeritus of the History of Consciousness at the University of California, Santa Cruz, and historian and philosopher of history, gave a talk with the intriguing title of The Future of Utopia in History. And he joins us now to tell us about it. Hayden White, welcome to the Philosopher's Zone.
Thank you, Alan.
Let's begin historically. We could certainly regard the Republic by Plato as a sort of utopia, though I don't know how many of us would actually want to live in Plato's Republic. But the actual word is of more recent coinage, isn't it?
Yes, it is. 16th century.
And the coinage is, I think, that of Sir Thomas More, or for our Catholic listeners, St. Thomas More.
St. Thomas, Sir Thomas, yes. 1516 was the date of original publication in Latin, published later on in English, but some 40 years later.
Well, we'll come on in a minute to the importance of his book, but just before we get to it, you said that utopian thinking consists of a number of different modes and genres. What are these modes and genres?
Okay, the choice of this topic for this International Congress of Historical Sciences had to do with the fact that traditionally, utopias are criticized because they violate the reality principle as represented by our knowledge of history. Utopias never work out. When you try to apply them, they always fail. This is the idea. Or when you try to use violence to bring them about, what you get is totalitarian regimes. Like Hitler's racially pure Germany or Europe would be an example of a kind of utopia, right? Or the Anabaptist desire to realize the second coming or the millennium or the rule of the saints in the 16th century would be another example. So utopia has a very bad name among historians, and many historians feel that wherever you have utopian speculation, you cannot have historical realism. Where you have historical realism, you will never have utopia. Historians never generally believe that you cannot predict the future on the basis of that, and they're against any kind of idealization of the past. So since most utopias are about idealizations of the past, or attempts to predict the future, it is thought, utopia and history have nothing in common. I want to make a distinction between the kind of utopian speculation, model building, if you call it, wish, inaugurated by Sir Thomas More, and the kind of visionary politics that derives from a belief in a second coming, in a Garden of Eden, in some kind of state of nirvana, or that sort of thing. I don't believe that when we speak about utopian thinking, we should violate the principle of historical concreteness. The utopian thinking is an invention of modernity. As modernity is taking shape in the 16th century, it's a peculiar creation of the West. And actually, More's utopia, although he cites Plato, has very little in common with Plato's utopia. Plato has a kind of ideal in mind that is not necessarily supposed to be applied.
So these utopias of the pre-modern period, like, as we've said, like Plato's Republic, or I suppose like these various medieval constructions like the Land of Cocaine, which is a sort of a version of the Big Rock Candy Mountain,
fantasy,
really.
Yes.
Yeah, they don't really count as utopias in any recognizably modern sense.
These are what I would call wish fulfillment fantasies. Land of Cocaine, where, you know, the sausages are hanging off the trees and you just pluck one. That's kind of an Edenic utopia. That, I think, is common to all cultures, where you imagine what would be the case if all of your wishes were fulfilled, if we didn't have to earn our bread in the sweat of our brow or give birth to children in pain, where you had nothing but a pleasure. These are typical psychological or psychoanalytical phenomenon, the wish fulfillment fantasy, and we have that in all cultures. Utopia, however, is a distinctively historical-specific genre of writing that has to do with critique of the present.
So it's interesting to hear Thomas More's Utopia being regarded as a paradigm of the modernist brand of utopian discourse, since this is a man who went to the block for his defence of Orthodox Roman Catholicism. But perhaps you could explain exactly what his book's about, what it has to say.
Well, what it does, I believe, is it's a very acute and very sapient perception of new forces that are emerging that will make modernity. This book appears the year before Martin Luther begins the Reformation. It is very cognizant of the impact of the new discoveries of the new world, of exploration of modern science, of a new way of thinking that will be represented above all by Bacon among in the years to follow. What I think it does is imagine possible world. I call it possible world philosophizing. It imagines what, on the basis of an awareness of the conflict between emergent and received traditions, institutions, and so forth, might be a possible future. There's nothing utopian about it. No one would like to live in More's utopia any more than they'd like to live in Plato's, unless they were the philosopher kings or something of that sort. But it has to do with the fact that More is trying to imagine what will happen after the enclosures, for example. The king has already embarked upon a program of closing the monasteries and things of that sort, already in conflict with the church. He's going to expropriate those lands. He's going to use them to endow a new class, a new middle class, give it lands, give it an investment in his totalitarian regime. And More apprehends this. And he asks, what could it be like in the best case? And he's aware of capitalism, too, which is displacing the older feudal system. So it's this aspect of More, I think, that appealed to Marx and then made Marx see him as a progenitor of a kind of visionary thinking that was grounded in historical reality.
What are the other characteristics, apart from the question of land ownership, what are the other characteristics of More's
utopia?
Well,
one of the things that More foresees is the possibility there will be a form of slavery, there will be free love, there the possibility of community of property. Under circumstances that are quite interesting to imagine when you think of these mega corporations that are sort of owning half the world, so that I think that there are anticipations of some of the worst aspects of a fully developed capitalism. He's very much aware of the necessity of saving the natural resources of the earth for human use. And so there's a kind of rational, calculative aspect to his thinking that you can see there. A lot of this has to do with what Max Weber will see as the dominant attribute of modernity in the West, which is rationalization.
This is Max Weber, the late 19th century German sociologist.
That's right, and social theorist and philosopher of society, yes. The idea that calculation, rational calculation, will be the dominant attribute of a capitalist society, which is augmented by and supplemented by a religious revolution in Calvinism especially, that promotes a similar kind of rational and calculative, what shall I call it, ethos, that will transform society in ways anticipated by many of these futuristic science fiction.
So More is, he's anticipating really late 19th century social thought. He's doing this,
I think so.
300 and more years before.
I believe so. Now, I'm the kind of historian who doesn't believe very much in historical influence. I think that people living in the present choose whom they're going to be influenced by. I mean, intellectuals especially. They survey the world of the past and pick and choose what they're going to use as their models. I prefer to think of this as providing models or paradigms that are picked up more or less completely by later social philosophers. But this is why I would make a distinction between the kind of utopian thinking that More represents on the one side and all of these kinds of mystical and religious utopias. And finally, a third kind of utopia, which is kind of based upon what I would call capitalistic fundamentalism of the kind you have in the United States now, represented by Mr. Bush and his ilk, that the present is utopia, that we have achieved this ideal state. We can do no better. And therefore, any kind of criticism of the present is treasonous or worse, a sin. I believe that this kind of utopian thinking is built into notions of progressivism and so forth, progress, the doctrine of progress, of the kind that developed in the 19th century, that saw the end of history as a utopian realization of Western capitalism's total control over every aspect of politics, society, and culture.
Given this view of utopias, or of Moore's kind of utopias, is there any distinction to be made? We commonly make a distinction between dystopia, which is a vision of, it's an anti-utopia, it's a vision of a rather grim possible world. Yes. Is there any distinction anymore really to be made between a dystopia and a utopia?
Visions of hell, of course, we've had since Babylon. Visions of the worst possible condition is given to us in Dante's Divine Comedy. I mean, you end up in hell, you end up, you know, in the anus of Satan in the worst case, than which there's no worse fate to befall you. But I think insofar as we're thinking about, after all, topia comes from topos, place. And so there's a good place, utopia, or actually it means no place, but eutopia in Greek would be the best place, the good place, and dystopia would be the bad place. So as modes of thinking, the present in view of a possible future, these would be belong to the same ilk. In science fiction writing, you have both kinds represented. Blade Runner is a good example of a dystopia, right? Sort of worst case scenario when you have a totalitarian regime administered by robots that have completely used up and destroyed the environment, so that you have acid rain as a continual situation. Yes, that would be a form of, let's call it topian thinking, that tries to imagine the world as a set of places. And these places, topoi, are some are good, some are bad. The interesting thing about our situation is that space is running out. The population revolution, mega-capitalism, and so forth, no longer allows you to imagine that the ideal place might be found in South, as Columbus thought, in South America, in a mountain where he thought the Garden of Eden was, where you could go into some backland out back and find an ideal relationship between human beings and their ecological niche. That's gone. The programs to colonize space, of course, a man on the moon, colonies on the moon, on Mars, this is the sort of megalomaniacal dreams that our president, my president, is setting forth now. These are really all kinds of fantasies of escape from a situation that has been rendered intolerable by the very forces of progress that these guys are celebrating and fighting wars to promote.
Well, our situation here is not intolerable, but we do have to escape from it. So, Haydn White, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you, Alan. I had a pleasure meeting you and talking to you.
I'm Alan Saunders, and I'll be back next week with another Philosopher's Zone. Coming up next on Radio National, the intellectual A-Utopia, which is Occam's Razor, presented as ever by Robin Williams.